Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1155. BioPsyOp Apocalypse Now, part 15. COVID-19 updates, part 5. I think it may be part 4, but I will have to go back and look at the previous shows. In any event, this is being recorded on October 4th of the year 2020. We will continue with our analysis of the COVID-19 pandemic. By the way, I should emphasize that when I used the term a plandemic, P-L-A-N-D-E-M-I-C, I was not using that in the context of a YouTube video suggesting that the whole pandemic was simply the result of 5G electromagnetic radiation and or a conspiracy by Bill Gates or whatever. Rather, the pandemic is not only occurring in the middle of a full court press against China involving both overt and covert operations, and a fairly explicit, not fairly explicit, but over-the-top explicit trade war against China. And in turn, there has been a huge Pentagon research project into precisely these kinds of viruses. And yet the discussion of the COVID-19 pandemic has failed to take this into account. So when I use the term plandemic, I'm talking about the indications not only that this is a biopsyop, but that it was deliberately intended as such. It is biological warfare at one level, and the largest false flag operation in history at another. I'm not in any way using the term plandemic to resonate with that YouTube video. I don't do YouTube videos myself. I rely on reading, but that is a point someone brought up, and it was a very thoughtful critic, so I thought I should indicate that. We are going to be talking about COVID-19 and vaccine development. In this context, people should remember a point that I have made repeatedly, namely that the distinction between offensive and defensive biological warfare is essentially academic. If you are studying how we beasties infect and sicken or kill animals or plants or humans, the research is the same whether or not it has been called quote offensive unquote or quote defensive unquote. In that context, and in the context of some of the rumination we will engage in this program, a couple of points of information from past broadcasts should be brought up to give us some real indications of what may, and again, what may be going on. From the book Gene Wars, Military Control Over the New Technologies by Charles Piller, P-I-L-L-E-R, and Keith R. Yamamoto, published in hardcover in 1988. The following observation from Jonathan King concerning vaccine development as a mask for offensive biological warfare research. Jonathan King is described here. King, who has chaired the microbial physiology study section for the National Institutes of Health, believes that without intensive independent scrutiny, the Pentagon is free to obscure its true goals. Quote, the Defense Department appears to be pursuing many narrow applied goals that are by nature offensive, such as the genetic, quote, improvement, unquote, of biological warfare agents. King says, again quoting, but to achieve political acceptability, they mask these intentions under forms of research such as vaccine development, which sound defensive. Moving, King's Observations, and that was again in a book published in 1988, more than 30 years ago. The Wikipedia entry on Unit 731, the notorious biological warfare program, arguably the most advanced on Earth at that point in time, and the program whose files, results, and some of the same personnel were incorporated into the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program at the end of World War II. What is interesting here for the purposes of the present discussion is what this notorious biological warfare unit was titled. It was officially called the Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Department of the Kwantung Army. And bridging the obviously camouflaged name of Unit 731, again incorporated into the American Biological Warfare Research Program at the end of World War II, and also Jonathan King's observations about how without intensive independent scrutiny, of course, there has been no such thing of the Pentagon since 1988, and he noted that the Defense Department appears to be pursuing many narrow applied goals that are by nature offensive, such as the genetic improvement, unquote, of biological warfare agents. But to achieve political acceptability, they mask these intentions under forms of research, such as vaccine development, which sound defensive. So bearing in mind Jonathan King's observations and the grotesquely, it's not ironic, but the camouflaged naming of Unit 731 as Epidemic Prevention. We will be taking a look at some things in this program which may very well be reflections of not only the ironic, well, not ironic, there I go again, but the deliberately camouflage name of Unit 731, whereas they were studying how to create epidemics, it was called the Epidemic Prevention Program, and noting how vaccine research can be used, in the opinion of Jonathan King, by the Pentagon or others, to mask offensive biological warfare research. And bearing in mind, again, that consummately important article from the Last American Vagabond blog of January 30th of 2020, this by Whitney Webb. Her work in general is uneven. This, however, is as important as anything I have read in 50 years of research and 42 years, well, I'm in my 42nd year on the air. The article, Bats, Gene Editing, and Bioweapons. Recent DARPA experiments raise concerns amid coronavirus outbreak, and a couple of excerpts. The Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA, began spending millions on such research into bat-borne coronaviruses bordering China in 2018, and some of these Pentagon-funded studies were conducted at known U.S. military bioweapons labs bordering China and resulted in the discovery of dozens of new coronavirus strains as recently as last April. Furthermore, the ties of the Pentagon's main biodefense lab to a virology institute in Wuhan, China, where the outbreak is believed to have begun, have been unreported in English-language media thus far. For instance, DARPA spent $10 million on one project in 2018, quote, to unravel the complex causes of bat-borne viruses that have recently made the jump to humans, causing concern among global health officials, unquote. Another research project backed by both DARPA and NIH saw researchers at Colorado State University examine the coronavirus that causes Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, in bats and camels, quote, to understand the role of these hosts in transmitting disease to humans, unquote. For instance, one study conducted in southern China in 2018 resulted in the discovery of 89 new novel bat coronavirus, unquote, strains that use the same receptor as the coronavirus known as Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. That study was jointly funded by the Chinese government's Ministry of Science and Technology, USAID, an organization long alleged to be a front for U.S. intelligence, and the U.S. National Institute of Health, which has collaborated with both the CIA and the Pentagon on infectious disease and bioweapons research. And again, that this occurs, the pandemic, occurs not only pursuant or in the wake of this massive Pentagon research into exactly these kinds of viruses, and as we will further develop, the involvement of not only Pentagon but CIA-linked in organizations with the Wuhan laboratory that is alleged to have been the laboratory that developed the virus, etc., in right-wing propaganda. But the pandemic occurs in the context of a full-court press against China involving covert operations in Hong Kong, as we have seen in, for the record, 1089, 90, and 91, involving the Uyghurs, as we have seen in so many different programs, and involving the, what I call the yellow journalism peril, a weaponized and thoroughly slanted media coverage of events Chinese that we looked at in our last couple of shows. A couple of things that bear scrutiny here and that we will be looking at greater length in this program. Again, bearing in mind the observations of Jonathan King that vaccine research can mask offensive biological warfare research, and also the brutally camouflaged title of Unit 7 for V1, the Epidemic Prevention Program, and also bear in mind my observations concerning the completely academic nature of offensive and defensive biological warfare research. One of the things that we will be looking at in this program concerns the possibility that programs such as the joint USAID-NIH Wuhan Institute of Virology program that are ostensibly and on the part of many of good faith operations into looking how to prevent pandemics or prevent epidemics can be used to the research developed therein can be used to develop epidemics. Again, the distinction between offensive and defensive biological warfare research is simply academic, and bearing in mind that the Unit 7 Preview 1, which was investigating how to cause epidemics, was called the Epidemic Prevention Program, we will look at some things, and once again, turning to that consummately important Whitney Webb article from The Last American Vagabond. Speaking of the research into bat-borne coronaviruses in China, many of these recent research projects are related to DARPA's Preventing Emerging Pathogenic Threats or PREEMPT program, in other words, an epidemic prevention program ostensibly. Many of these recent research projects are related to DARPA's Preventing Emerging Pathogenic Threats or PREEMPT program, which was officially announced in April of 2018. PREEMPT focuses specifically on animal reservoirs of disease, specifically bats, and DARPA even noted in its press release in the program that it is, quote, aware of biosafety and biosecurity sensitivities that could arise due to the nature of the research. And in addition, while both DARPA's PREEMPT program and the Pentagon's open interest in bats as bioweapons were announced in 2018, the U.S. military, specifically the Department of Defense's Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, began funding research involving bats and deadly pathogens, including the coronaviruses MERS and SARS, a year prior to that in 2017. 17. In recent programs, we have taken a look at how both the therapeutic drug remdesivir and also the rapidly developing Moderna messenger RNA vaccine against SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, got off to very, very quick starts. And we asked the question about to what extent research that was going on at among other institutions, the Army's Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, that was closed down by the CDC in early August of 2019, to what extent that research into MERS and SARS may have been connected with biological warfare research that was presented as epidemic prevention or what have you. And in the context of not only Jonathan King's observations about how vaccines can be used to mask offensive biological warfare research, consider the following. And this is, again, in an interrogatory mode. With Moncef Slaoui, who was in charge of product development for Moderna, which along with Inovio was one of the companies that received DARPA financing and that has been tabbed to help develop coronavirus vaccines. Consider the following. Concerns about Pentagon experiments with biological weapons have garnered renewed media attention, particularly after it was revealed in 2017 that DARPA was the top funder of the controversial gene drive technology, which has the power to permanently alter the genetics of entire populations while targeting others for extinction. One more time. Concerns about Pentagon experiments with biological weapons have garnered renewed media attention, particularly after it was revealed in 2017 that DARPA was the top funder of the controversial gene drive technology, which has the power to permanently alter the genetics of entire populations while targeting others for extinction. At least two of DARPA's studies using this controversial technology were classified and, quote, focused on the potential military application of gene drive technology and the use of gene drives in agriculture, unquote, according to media reports. The revelation came after an organization called the ETC Group obtained over 1,000 emails on the military's interest in the technology as part of a Freedom of Information Act request. Co-director of the ETC group, Jim Thomas, said that this technology may be used as a biological weapon. Gene drives are a powerful and dangerous new technology, and potential biological weapons could have disastrous impacts on peace, food security, and the environment, especially if misused. The fact that gene drive development is now being primarily funded and structured by the U.S. military raises alarming questions about this entire field. Well, it does indeed, and I wonder about the Moderna and Inovio vaccines. I have no idea whether those do involve gene drive technology. Certainly, I think we need to be on the alert for this kind of thing because, again, with DARPA-linked companies and with a rushed vaccine approval protocol for a type of vaccine, and again, both the DNA vaccines of Inovio and the mRNA vaccines of Moderna, both companies with DARPA funding, they have never been tried in human beings. Noting some of the DARPA backing of these companies, again, from the Whitney Webb article from the last American Vagabond blog, The second pharmaceutical company that was selected by CEPI to develop a vaccine for the new coronavirus is Moderna Incorporated, which will develop a vaccine for the novel coronavirus of concern in collaboration with the U.S. NIH and which will be funded entirely by CEPI. The vaccine in question, as opposed to Inovio's DNA vaccine, will be a messenger RNA vaccine. Though different than a DNA vaccine, mRNA vaccines still use genetic material, quote, to direct the body's cells to produce intracellular membrane or secreted proteins, unquote. Moderna's mRNA treatments, including its mRNA vaccines, were largely developed using a $25 million grant from DARPA, and it often touts its strategic alliance with DARPA in press releases. Still more. The very companies recently chosen to develop a vaccine to combat the coronavirus outbreak are themselves strategic allies of DARPA. For instance, the top funders of Inovio Pharmaceuticals include both DARPA and the Pentagon's Defense Threat Reduction Agency, or DTRA, and the company has received millions of dollars in grants from DARPA, including a $45 million grant to develop a vaccine for Ebola. Inovio specializes in the creation of DNA immunotherapies and DNA vaccines, which contain genetically engineered DNA that causes the cells of the recipient to produce an antigen and can permanently alter a person's DNA. Inovio previously developed a DNA vaccine for the Zika virus, but to date, no DNA vaccine has ever been approved for use in humans in the U.S. Inovio was also recently awarded over $8 million from the U.S. military to develop a small, portable intradermal device for delivering DNA vaccines that was jointly developed by Inovio and USAMRIID. So again, as we take a look at information, some of which is new, some of which is review, bearing in mind the fact, again, that offensive and defensive biological warfare research are essentially the same research, bearing in mind that both that vaccines, in the opinion of Jonathan King, can be used to, the development of vaccines can be used to mask offensive biological warfare research, bearing in mind the Orwellian name of Unit 731, Epidemic Prevention Program, when in fact it was an epidemic causing program, and bearing in mind the gene drive technology and the DARPA interest in these very, and the very kinds of bat-borne coronaviruses that have caused this pandemic, we will take a look at, some very unsavory things. Speaking, by the way, of Moncef Slaoui, again, he was in charge of product development for Moderna. Then he was appointed by Donald Trump as head of Operation Warp Speed, and his top assistant is a four-star general, General Gustav Perna. An interesting detail was presented about Moncef Slaoui in the ProPublica blog of September 23rd of 2020. This is by Isaac Arnsdorf, A-R-N-S-D-O-R-F. Trump's vaccine czar refuses to give up stock in company involved in his government role. Skipping down. Health and Human Services previously said that Slaoui, quote, does not have any additional stock holdings in any other companies involved in vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostic products developed to combat COVID-19. But in addition to Slaoui's retained GlaxoSmithKline shares, the records obtained by the House Democrats revealed that he has a holding in another biotechnology company, Lonza Group, that's capital L-O-N-Z-A, that was not previously disclosed. one more time. But in addition to Slowey's retained GlaxoSmithKline shares, the records obtained by the House Democrats reveal that he has a holding in another biotechnology company, Lonza Group, that was not previously disclosed. The company has a contract with Moderna to manufacture its coronavirus vaccine. Slowey resigned from Lonza's board before joining Operation Warp Speed, but kept his shares in the company. The records released by the House committee do not show how much the stake was worth. So, the head of Operation Warp Speed, Monseth Slowey, obviously has a stake literally in the successful manufacture and deployment of the Moderna vaccine. He is still a shareholder in one of the companies, Lonza, again, L-O-N-Z-A, that will be manufacturing the Moderna vaccine. And speaking of the Inovia vaccine, an article from James Barron from the New York Times, Western edition of September 29th, 2020, vaccine on partial clinical hold. Another vaccine trial was delayed. Inovio Pharmaceutical, parenthetically, another of the DARPA-funded companies that we looked at in the Whitney Webb article, Inovio Pharmaceutical said on Monday that the Food and Drug Administration had put the mid to late stage trials of its Accineon, A-C-C-I-N-E-O-N, on a partial clinical hold, unquote. Inovio, a Pennsylvania biotechnology company whose chief executive boasted to President Trump in March that it was the world's leader in coronavirus vaccines, said the pause was related to side effects detected in the first phase testing of its vaccine, developed from a computer algorithm that identifies the DNA sequence of the antigen. Of course, one of the problems in connection with the vaccines, and when you have mRNA vaccines or DNA vaccines that have not been tried, one of the potential threats is indeed these side effects, which can can manifest long after the vaccine has been given. In our discussions with Ed Haslam and in For the Record Program 694, we took a look at the pollution of the polio vaccine with a cancer-causing monkey virus, SV40, and the epidemic of soft tissue cancers that appears to have been produced by that vaccine pollution. I should stress in passing again that I am not an anti-vaxxer. I think that vaccines, when properly made and vetted, are a fundamental element in successful management of the public health. However, when either Big Pharma and or the government does not properly vet vaccine development, and possibly when some are used as covers for biological warfare programs, all bets are off. I certainly do not trust the Trump administration or Operation Warp Speed with the massive conflicts of interest that these people have, and also the omnipresence of the Pentagon in so much of this work. The Pentagon is in the business of warfighting. That is about killing people and destroying or appropriating property. They are not in the business of maintaining the public health. Now, a column by Charles Blow of the New York Times that was printed on September 21st of 2020 in the West. It is called "Conservatives Try to Lock in Power," and I think this column will serve as an important vehicle for our discussion, something that we're going to have to undertake at greater length in future shows, of what the full court press against China is really all about, and also what things stretching from the Supreme Court packing that the Trump administration is obviously engaged in, rather than delaying or refusing to hold hearings on Amy Coney Barrett, as they did with Merrick Garland, Barack Obama's appointment to replace Judge Antonin Scalia. They are fast-tracking the hearings for Ms. Barrett, for Judge Barrett. I think, however, as accurately as the Charles Blow column, or as accurate as Charles Blow's column is, I think it offers us a key to some much larger applications. Reading portions of this column, again, conservatives tried to lock in power by Charles Blow from the New York Times of September 21st of 2020. This is all about power for a group of people who feel their grip on power slipping away. They are trying to reshape the courts for a generation, if not longer, so that as their numerical advantage slips away, their power imbalance will have already been enshrined. As America becomes less religious and less white, more galvanized to fight climate change and more aware of systemic racism, the religious conservative spine of the Republican Party is desperate for a way to save a way of life that may soon be rendered a relic. According to the Pew Research Center, 78% of white evangelical voters are Republicans or lean Republican. So are 62% of white men without a college degree, 60% of rural Southerners, and 50% of people who attend religious services weekly. Many of those demographics are under threat. The U.S. will be majority-minority by 2045, and by 2060, there will be nearly as many Hispanic children in the country as white ones. That is why they happily cheered Trump's attack on immigrants, both legal and undocumented. It is why they encourage efforts to disenfranchise voters. It is why Trump's attacks on cities resonate, as does his Make America Great Again mantra, and in the context of cities. Urbanization means that many of those southern rural areas are losing population. For instance, an Atlanta Journal Constitution analysis last year reported by the AP found that, quote, more than half of the small towns in Georgia, those with populations under 10,000, have lost population since 2010, meaning only one in six towns with populations of 10,000 or above have lost residents. Okay, I should say, not meaning, but meanwhile, only one in six towns with populations of 10,000 or above have lost residents. Lastly, the percentage of Americans with college degrees keeps rising, moving from 4.6% in 1940 to 36% in 2019. And college graduates tend to vote pro-Democratic and against Republicans. And I would note that the way the pandemic is being handled is in precisely the in concert with what Charles Blow, accurately in my opinion, has stated about the Republicans' aims at voter suppression, their aims at stocking not only the Supreme Court but the courts in general. This is all about power for a group of people who fear their grip on power slipping away. With regard to China, China is not a superpower. It is, however, growing very rapidly. Also, it is really communist in name only. A much better term would be state capitalism, and as Kurt Anderson pointed out in a book review that we covered some weeks back, really what China did was to switch from communism to capitalism while keeping the chassis of their political system intact. They are, however, Melville, not a superpower. They are making enormous progress. In 1981, 88% of the Chinese population lived in poverty. That was down to 0.7% in 2015. The Chinese middle class was 4% of their population in 2002. By 2018, that was up to 31% of their population. In 2000, just 2% of the Chinese population had access to the internet. That was up to 29% by 2009. The point being that what really is a public-private partnership is working very, very effectively and quickly in China. And given the fact that China is one of the largest countries on Earth geographically and is the most populous country on Earth with between a quarter and a fifth of the world's population, it is looming very, very large as a power. I would note that in the context of the propaganda we're being told in this country, the U.S., despite having a smaller geographical area and a much smaller population, spends four times as much on our military as China spends on theirs. However, China, which was for years the focal point of brutal subjection by Western imperial powers, is no longer subject to that oppression, and they are growing very, very quickly. Third world countries, developing countries, are looking to China as a possible model for the development of their own country. This is not lost on the U.S. and the West, and the fact that a former colonial country is making this kind of progress and that other developing countries are looking at that progress and asking whether that could be a model for their own is in and of itself unacceptable to the West. The full court press against China and the COVID-19 pandemic in particular are instituted, there are events that signal a fundamental negation of the pretense of Western society. Rather than the pretense of helping less developed countries to develop and become modern market-oriented economies, basically I think the full court press against China and the pandemic are in and of themselves fundamentally white supremacist. China was a former colonial country, and the Chinese are not white. And for that reason, they will not be permitted to become a great power that can challenge the U.S. or even vault past the U.S. in any regard. The Chinese are, in my opinion, to be subjugated, or at the very least, restricted so that their developmental model does not become something that is taken up in the rest of the developing countries, which the West, in my opinion, would really like to keep on the present course of events and action. We'll talk more about China, its past, and its history. I really don't think one can understand China or Asia without reading the book Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. We have used that book many times in the past. It would be an excellent way to do that. But what we're going to take a look at right now is how the pandemic is doing what Charles Blow is talking about, conservatives trying to lock in power. It is hurting people of color, black and Latino people. It is hurting institutions that are inimical to the Trump and to the right wing, from basically non-governmental organizations to a variety of different things. It is basically performing a right-wing agenda. Noting in particular how the trend toward urbanization and toward better education are working against the locking in of power by the conservatives, the GOP, and the Trump right. just a brief look at some headlines vis-a-vis what the pandemic is doing to education, both public schools and college education, and what it is doing to major cities. A very quick run of their activities from the New York Times of Saturday, August 15th of 2020 by Gianna Smiolek, Alan Rappaport, and Emily Cochran. Economic pain looms in cities and in states. And right next to that, they can't afford a learning pod, now what? By Amy Goodnow. Hiring of private tutors by wealthy widens the education divide. And again, it is the virus is working against the trend that basically working against the trends that will hurt the right wing and the GOP. It is working in the way that Charles Blow said the conservatives were working to lock in power. From the New York Times of Wednesday, August 19th of 2020. This by Emily Badger and Kwok Chung Bui, B-U-I. The recession will slam cities and not just blue state ones. Yes, indeed. This is what Charles Blow was talking about. Still more from the New York Times of Thursday, August 27th of 2020. This by Christina Goldbaum. Transit forecast, drastic cuts without aid. This, obviously, public transit is one of the things upon which people in major cities depend. That will hurt them as well. Still more from the New York Times of Tuesday, July 21st of 2020 by Eduardo Porter, P-O-R-T-E-R. If workers opt out, star cities may dim. Cities are remarkably resilient. They have risen from the ashes after being carpet bombed and hit with nuclear weapons. Quote, if you think about pandemics in the past, noted the Princeton economist Esteban Rossi Hansberg, quote, they didn't destroy cities. That is because cities are valuable. And skipping down. And yet, there is a lingering sense that this time might be different. The pandemic threatens the assets that make America's most successful cities so dynamic, not only their bars, museums, and theaters, but also their dense networks of innovative businesses and highly skilled workers. Still more from the New York Times of Wednesday, August 12th of 2020, by Matthew Haig and Patrick McGeehan. National chains abandon Manhattan. It's unsustainable, unquote. And still more about what is taking place in New York City. This, again, from the New York Times of Tuesday, September 29th of 2020, by Dana Rubenstein. Virus pushing New York into a financial abyss. And from the New York Times of Wednesday, September 9th of 2020, by Julie Creswell and Peter Evis, E-A-V-I-S. Ghostly offices haunt New York as rebound lags. Yes, indeed. And in addition to doing the very thing to cities that will benefit the far right, and noting that the trend of people moving to cities is benefiting the Democrats and hurting the Republicans. Two articles right next to each other in the New York Times of Friday, July 17th. Some schools, private, are opening, while others, public, are not. This by Claire Kane Milligan. Right underneath that, colleges turn to layoffs as finances shrivel up. This by Daniel McGraw, Sean Huber, and Dan Levin. More about what is being done to education. The same thing that is being done to cities. New York Times, Saturday, June 6th of 2020. Virus closures leave students falling behind. This by Dana Goldstein. Gaps of race and class are likely to widen. And still more. From the New York Times of Saturday, August 29th of 2020, by Pranshu Verma. End of the line, unquote. Pandemic leaves the private school bus industry in crisis. Again, That will hurt education. It will also hurt urban children even more. New York Times, from Sunday, June 7th of 2020, op-ed column by Frank Bruni. Is this the end of college as we knew it? And also from the New York Times of Saturday, September 5th of 2020, this by Paul Sullivan. Will gifts to colleges keep on giving? An annuity ensures income and leaves a donation, but the pandemic imperils some schools' finances. Again, doing to cities and doing to colleges, what will benefit the GOP? New York Times, Thursday, May 7th of 2020. As states' revenue disappears, so might the public in public colleges. This is by Kevin Carey. Again, look what the pandemic is doing to education, both elementary school and at the college level. New York Times of Thursday, May 28th of 2020, by Anamona Hartkollis, Hartkollis. Scattered to the winds, college students struggle. And still more about colleges from the New York Times of Friday, July 3rd of 2020. Planning for fall, colleges face a revolt among professors. Certainly will not do well. And in general, the tension surrounding the opening of schools is enormous. The New York Times of Sunday, June 7th. How to reopen America's schools. This is an editorial. Parental anxiety is stridently evident in recent polls, including one released last month by USA Today and Ipsos. Elected officials should find it sobering that 6 in 10 parents say they are likely to continue home learning instead of sending their kids back to school this fall. 1 in 5 teachers say they are unlikely to return to their classrooms. And when parents and teachers are considered together, about 4 in 10 oppose returning to school at all until the coronavirus vaccine is available. In other words, possibly years from now. Hurting cities, hurting public education, the public schools, hurting colleges, both things that the Charles Blow column said will benefit the people who want to keep things, as he put it, conservatives trying to lock in power for a generation. Again, Charles Blow, September 21st of 2020. And some very interesting questions were brought to bear. These are not things that are new to our focus, but the New York Times had an article by William J. Broad on July 14th. Disease detective put forth pointed questions, unquote. This is about a guy named Dr. Daniel R. Lucy, who has indeed had some interesting things to say. He talked about the gain-of-function manipulations that we have spoken about at great length and asked if perhaps some of those may have been involved in enhancing these pathogens. We asked exactly those questions. And he also raises questions about some gain-of-function manipulations of not only coronaviruses, but of the H5N1 flu. We look at that, and for the record, 1116, 1117, and 1121. Those gain-of-function experiments were put on hold in 2014, but the Trump administration then resumed those in 2017. And in this article, he notes, a Chinese study found that cats and ferrets were highly susceptible to the pathogen. Ferrets were one of the, they are frequently used to study aerial-borne viruses that infect humans. Specifically, some of the H5N1 avian flu gain-of-function experiments involved adapting that virus to ferrets, and that adaptation made the H5N1 basically communicable via casual respiratory activity. Reading this article, and we'll pick this up at greater length in our next show. Again, disease detective put forth pointed questions by William J. Broad from the New York Times of July 14th of 2020. The 6th And seventh questions go to whether the deadly pathogen leaked to humans from a laboratory. Although some intelligence analysts and scientists have entertained that scenario, no direct evidence has come to light suggesting that the coronavirus escaped from one of Wuhan's labs. Even so, given the wet market's downgrading in the investigation, quote, it is important to address questions about any potential laboratory source of the virus, whether in Wuhan or elsewhere, unquote, Dr. Daniel R. Lucy wrote in his blog post. And again, in this country, we've heard all about Wuhan. I think from what he wrote, he is at least aware of the possibility that, the virus may have come from a laboratory. I'll guarantee you it came from a laboratory, but not necessarily in Wuhan. Although, as we have seen and as we review, certainly on our next show, we will probably touch on it here. The Wuhan Institute of Virology did involve a program looking into these kinds of viruses, and U.S., including U.S. intelligence or fronts or organizations that have fronted for U.S. intelligence, such as the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, were co-funders of those projects. Again, resuming with what Daniel Lucy has said, even so, given the wet market's downgrading in the investigation, quote, it is important to address questions about any potential laboratory source of the virus, whether in Wuhan or elsewhere, unquote, Dr. Daniel R. Lucy wrote in his blog post. To that end, he urges the WHO investigators to look for any signs of gain-of-function, unquote, research, the deliberate enhancement of pathogens to make them more dangerous. The technique is highly contentious. Critics question its merits and warn that it could lead to catastrophic lab leaks. Proponents see it as a legitimate way to learn how viruses and other infectious organisms might evolve to infect and kill people and thus help in devising new protections and precautions. Debate over its wisdom erupted in 2011 after researchers announced success in making the highly lethal H5N1 strain of avian flu easily transmissible through air between ferrets, at least in the laboratory. In his blog, Dr. Lucy asks what, if any, unquote, gain-of-function studies were done on coronaviruses in Wuhan, elsewhere in China, or in collaboration with foreign laboratories. If done well, scientifically, then this investigation should allay persistent concerns about the origin of this virus, he wrote. It could also help set an improved standard for investigating and stopping the awful viruses and other pathogens in the decades ahead. Finally, Dr. Lucy asked the WHO team to learn more about China's main influenza research lab, a highly secure facility in Harbin, the capital of China's northernmost province. In May, he notes, a Chinese paper in the journal Science reported that two virus samples from Wuhan were studied there in great detail early this year, including in a variety of animals. It reported that cats and ferrets were highly susceptible to the pathogen. And as we have noted in past programs, and as we will review, there was a joint Chinese and U.S. program at the Wuhan Institute of Virology and also in the U.S. that was funded not only by the NIH that has served as a front for Pentagon and CIA research in the past, although it is obviously the National Institutes of Health are far more than the Pentagon and or CIA fronts. USAID is also much larger than simply a CIA front, but it has been used as a CIA front in the past, and that those organizations were involved in this dual U.S. and Chinese project at the Wuhan Laboratory. From the Scientist magazine of November 16th of 2015, Lab-Made Coronavirus Triggers Debate by Jeff Oxt. And this is that joint Chinese-American program funded at the U.S. and by organizations that have served as fronts for intelligence community in the past. Dr. Ralph Barish, B-A-R-I-C, an infectious disease researcher at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill last week, November 9th, published a study on his team's effort to engineer a virus with the surface protein of the SHCO14 coronavirus found in horseshoe bats in China and the backbone of one that causes human-like severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, in mice. The hybrid virus could infect human airway cells and cause disease in mice. The results demonstrate the ability of the SHCO14 surface protein to bind and infect human cells, validating concerns that this virus or other coronaviruses found in bat species may be capable of making the leap to people without first evolving in an intermediate host, Nature reported. They also reignited the debate about whether that information justifies the risk of such work known as gain-of-function research. Quote, if the new virus escaped, nobody could predict the trajectory, Simon Wayne Hobson, a virologist at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, told Nature. But Barish and others argued the study's importance. The results moved this virus from a candidate emerging pathogen to a clear and present danger. Peter Bazak, president of the EcoHealth Alliance, which samples viruses from animals and people in emerging disease hotspots across the globe, told Nature. And the EcoHealth Alliance is one of these epidemic prevention, unquote, programs. And again, many of the people, perhaps most of the people involved in these, may be absolutely sincere in their desire to prevent pandemics. But the same research that can be used to, quote, prevent pandemics can be used to deliberately cause them as well. And this program, again, the EcoHealth Alliance, is that program jointly funded by China and organizations that have fronted for U.S. intelligence in the past. And also that laboratory, the WIV, has been the focal point, and these programs have been the focal point of propaganda, part of the yellow journalism peril in the Western press, such as the Murdoch's Daily Telegraph from Australia from May 4th of 2020. Coronavirus, New South Wales. Dossier lays out case against China bat virus program by Sherry, S-H-A-R-R-I, Markson. And again, this is that EcoHealth Alliance project, USAID project Predict that we will talk about at greater length in our next show. Their November 2015 study, done in conjunction with the University of North Carolina, concluded that SARS-like virus could jump directly from bats to humans and that there was no treatment that could help. And one of Dr. Shi's co-authors on that paper, Professor Ralph Barish from North Carolina University, said in an interview with Science Daily at the time, this virus is highly pathogenic and treatments developed against the original SARS virus in 2002 and the ZMapp drugs used to fight Ebola failed to neutralize and control this particular virus. So again, are some of these programs like Project Predict, the EcoHealth Alliance project, and some of the Pentagon Project Preempt, obviously, that is defense-oriented. But again, asking the question, are vaccine development or, quote, epidemic prevention, unquote, are these actually masking for offensive biological warfare research? And noting the Wuhan laboratory certainly raises some interesting questions. We will continue with this review and our interrogatory in our next program. This, however, concludes For the Record program number 1155, BioPsyOp Apocalypse Now, Part 15, COVID-19 Updates, Part 4. This is being recorded on October 4th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.